Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Today I'll be talking to two retired Chico State professors who have each written books about terrorism. They say the United States rationalizes its own terrorist actions and dodges the terrorism label. Later in the hour, Professor Bo Grosskopf will recount the history of aerial bombardment of civilian populations throughout the 20th century and up to the present day, and how terrorism is a politically loaded concept. His most recent book is Strategic Terror, The Politics and Ethics of Aerial Bombardment. Today we war against terrorism, although we're not exactly sure what it is. My first guest says that terrorism didn't always get bad press. During World War II, it was praised as a strategy for winning wars and afterwards for keeping the peace. But today's officials take offense when charged with terrorist practices. They insist that U.S. policymakers and jihadists inhabit quite different moral universes. My first guest, retired Professor Ron Hirschbein, is a philosopher who looks at the calculated use of violence to accomplish goals in foreign policy. At California State University, he taught philosophy and war and peace studies for over 30 years and founded the university's Peace Institute. His PhD is in social science from Syracuse University, and he was a visiting professor of peace and conflict studies at the University of California campuses in Berkeley and San Diego. He is the author of five books on radical humanistic approaches to international affairs. His most recent is The United States and Terrorism, An Ironic Perspective. Ron Hirschbein, welcome.
Well, thank you, and pleased to be on your show, Nancy.
Well, your book, The United States and Terrorism, An Ironic Perspective, and that raises a lot of questions right away when we hear the title of your book. The United States and Terrorism, we think, oh, yeah, we've been the victims of terrorism.
Yeah, it seems to me in studying this that so many people are irony challenged. As as you mentioned earlier, terrorism didn't always get bad press. On the contrary, terrorism was celebrated as indispensable for winning World War II. We find, for example, General Curtis LeMay boasting that the U.S. Army Air Force was going to obliterate scores of Japanese cities. And of course, there were the raids on Germany. In addition, the use of the ultimate terror weapon, atomic bomb, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Curiously, the official U.S. government strategic bombing survey questions whether the atomic bomb was necessary. In fact, other documents suggest that the U.S. terror bombing of Japan and Germany was somewhat gratuitous because the majority of it occurred after the Allies concluded that the Axis powers would be defeated. But in any case, in the conventional literature, had we been talking during World War II, we'd have no difficulty understanding what terrorism is. It meant terror bombing. And it meant sending a village, not only killing civilians, but sending the signature message of terrorism: be afraid, be terribly afraid. So it was celebrated during World War II for winning the war, in effect. And rather ironically, it was celebrated during much of the Cold War for keeping the peace. Nuclear terrorism was seen as a blessing in disguise. I quote Churchill, who was quite adept at phrase-mongering.
Yes.
Churchill wrote, "By a process of sublime irony, we've reached a state where safety will be the sturdy child of terror and survival, the twin brother of annihilation." So during the Cold War, terrorism is lauded for keeping the peace. And in establishment journals such as Foreign Affairs, we have extensive writing about what was needed to properly titrate the delicate balance of terror. how many Soviet civilians would have to be killed. The estimate was the U.S. would need enough nuclear ordnance to annihilate at least half the Soviet population. And there's further irony. I mean, the more I dug into this, the more ironic it became. During World War II, as probably most people realize, the Japanese were demonized as an entire race. And there was considerable demonizing of the German people, although a distinction was made for good Germans and Nazis. Nonetheless, they were certainly portrayed as enemies. The curious thing about plans to obliterate half the Soviet population, the Soviet people were deemed our friends. Time and again, the U.S. Congress passed the Captive Nations resolution, urging the American people to pray for the well-being of those held captive behind the Iron Curtain. So while the American people were supposed to pray for Soviet civilians, plans were made to annihilate them in the event of a nuclear war. And funny thing, somehow I find that rather ironic.
My guest is retired Professor Ron Hirschbein, and his book is The United States and Terrorism, An Ironic Perspective. And as you're growing up and you're going to school and as a student, when did it dawn on you that our view of terrorism was ironic?
Well, particularly much later in my life, post 9/11, where rightly so, the people who perpetrated that atrocity were rightly demonized, and was a horrific act. But then, as I looked into it further, I found not only the irony of World War II and the Cold War, but this policy of carpet bombing civilians in pursuit of victory or stalemate was practiced in Korea, Vietnam, and Iraq. And then I also developed a sense of proportionality, at least I'd like to think so. For every innocent killed by a jihadist, and it's tragic and, of course, deplorable, no question there, but how many have been killed by legitimate nation states? How many millions were killed in Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Dresden, and Tokyo? Well, Robert McNamara allows that he should have been tried as a war criminal for orchestrating the firebombing of Tokyo during the war. But much later than that, as we read in a study in the Lancet magazine, the premier British medical journal. The Johns Hopkins University School of Public Health did an estimate as to how many civilians perished in the second Iraq War due directly and indirectly to the U.S. invasion. Their estimate was about 650,000. But curiously, just recently, former Ambassador Madeleine Albright has gotten some press for being critical of those who don't support Hillary Clinton. But it's certainly worth mentioning that she was interviewed in 60 Minutes in the aftermath of the first Iraq War. And Leslie Stahl quoted a United Nations study suggesting that approximately 500,000 Iraqi children perished due to the U.S. invasion during the first Iraq War and its aftermath.
So we don't want to hear that. We don't want to hear that, Ron. We're the good guys.
I know. This is precisely the problem, which is why this book maybe will not win friends and influence people. But in any case, confronted with that figure, Madeleine Albright didn't deny it. She said, well, you know, this was a hard choice, but the right thing to do. So just imagine for a moment Osama bin Laden or some of the ISIS people say, well, killing all these civilians was a hard choice, but we think it's the right thing to do. Years ago, the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr defined the signature of the nation state as hypocrisy. So what is the proper ratio? For every innocent killed by a jihadist, tragically enough, how many have perished at the hands of nation states? What's the proper ratio? Perhaps a million to one?
My guest is retired Professor Ron Hirschbein. He taught philosophy at Chico State University for 30 years, and he also was there's a Peace Institute at the university, and he was the founder of that Peace Institute. His book is The United States and Terrorism, An Ironic Perspective. You mentioned Curtis LeMay, and I've never heard him referred to as a terrorist, but from what you've been saying, he would qualify.
Well, yeah, in the and this is one thing I want to mention at the risk of being overly rhetorical or tendentious. You mentioned a study where an academic interviewed certain jihadists and tried to figure out what makes them tick. Mm-hmm. Curiously, why haven't people, I mean, McNamara and Curtis LeMay are no longer with us, but why aren't U.S. policymakers interviewed to see what makes them tick and how these people who are in some ways desk murderers, why don't we want to find out what makes them tick? In the book, to come back to your point, I quote Curtis LeMay, who was effervescing about what he was going to do in bombing Europe. And he talked about bodies set afire floating in the canals of Europe, cities set aflame time and time again. Somehow I think most people would say that smacks of terrorism. He was the advocate of target bombing against civilians to demoralize the enemy. 67 Japanese cities were obliterated through firebombing.
You know, you posed an interesting question because Dr. Ann Speckhard, that wrote about, who interviewed jihadists and terrorists mm-hmm. there, lives in Washington, D.C. Her husband was an ambassador in the past.
I see.
And I just imagine her knocking on the door of some policymaker and for an idea for another book and saying, I'd like to interview you and ask you about your motivations, I think they would probably slam the door in her face.
Yeah, it isn't the way to win friends and influence people. So there is a lot of state worship, a lot of enthusiastic, uncritical examination of what the U.S. does. I call it just terrorism theory. But one of the other, coming back to my sense of irony here is it's pretty clear that terrorism didn't always get bad press. But I'm trying to tell the story as to how did it come to be that terrorism did in fact get bad press.
Mm-hmm. And that it went from being something we would do for keeping the peace to something now we became victims of.
Yeah, yeah. It again, celebrated for winning wars and keeping the peace, suddenly it became the most loathsome, despicable action. In fact, even worse than death, as I mentioned in the book, you'll find headlines like this. Family found murdered lying in their beds, but take heart, it wasn't terrorism.
Yeah.
Or airline crashes, but...
It wasn't terrorism. Because that's our first thought. Oh,
yeah, so I'm sure
again.
The survivors feel better. But here's a story. What happened? And maybe to give this a little bit more gravitas in terms of philosophy and history, the ancient Greek historian and general Thucydides put it like this in talking about the wars of his time. He concluded that, I'm paraphrasing here, but this is pretty close. He concluded that the strong do what they want and the weak must endure the consequences. And so it was in the Peloponnesian Wars. Mm-hmm. And that seemed like a perfectly natural and desirable state of affairs for the strong nation states to do as they will, for good and many times for evil. What happened, though, is that these jihadists that we now call terrorists turned Thucydides on his head, and that seemed deplorable and perfectly unnatural. In other words, the weak did what they wanted, and the strong had to endure the consequences. A totally unacceptable state of affairs. And people refusing to make the connection that what we do to them and what they do to us are not unrelated. So there's supposed to be some great mystery as to why these jihadists get radicalized. And of course, there are many reasons. I don't want to simply reduce this to U.S. policy. But nonetheless, U.S. actions need to be given proper weight. If we read some of the literature coming out of Al-Qaeda and other movements like that, we find that they were rather attentive to what Madeleine Albright had to say, and they were taking it rather personally when somebody talked about the necessity of killing 500,000 Muslim children, or 600,000 civilian deaths in Iraq, or overthrowing the duly elected president of Iran in 1953. And so it goes. So what we do to them and what they do to us are not unrelated. And I try to reveal some of these relationships in the studies. But I do want to have a chance. Do I have time to talk about the most ironic part of the book?
Yeah.
Okay, but you had another question.
That though first, because I was going to mention that you are part of Concerned Philosophers for Peace. But what were you going to say about the irony in your book?
Well, the strongest irony is that terrorism has now become a great pretext for entertainment. So this thing that we find most despicable and the thing that's most frightening has now become entertaining. I mentioned that in an interview with the New York Times, President Obama mentioned his favorite show, Homeland. Or going back a little bit further, as the second Iraq War started when Bush was president, newsflash, no weapons of mass destruction were found. What did President Bush do during the journalist dinner in Washington? He made sport of that. What happened is that shock and awe turned to awe shucks. And thanks for getting that. So what he did was to stage this burlesque where he was pretending to look for weapons of mass destruction behind the curtains and under desks and in desk drawers and everybody had a big laugh, except, of course, the American and Iraqi victims of the war. They had a real big laugh because Bush was, through what I call cognitive insolence, just mocking the, to be charitable, the mistakes. But the entertainment continues. Try to think of some primetime show, maybe 24, typical cop shows that don't rely on the terrorist genre. One thing I also considered was my magical mystery tour of U.S. atomic facilities in New Mexico, the Trinity site where the first atomic bomb was set off on one early July morning. But it was a pretext for entertainment. There were all kinds of souvenir stands, and you could buy T-shirts saying that I glow in the dark. You could get the fabulous New Mexico green chilies if you so desired. So it was a great place for a picnic. Maybe one of the more egregious things, speaking of 9/11, is the 9/11 monument in New York City, and many of the people who had victims in that terrible tragedy are very, very exercised by the gift shop and the souvenirs. You can, for example, get souvenir dog sweaters with a 9/11 emblem on it. So there's just a variety of tasteless kitsch use for entertainment. As far as Homeland is concerned, my hunch, an argument I made in a recently published article, was that knowingly and unknowingly, Homeland showcases Obama's version of the war on terrorism, which I call terrorism light. He realized the folly of massive land invasions of the greater Middle East. So instead, he, I guess, vis-a-vis Homeland, practices covert operations and, of course, the drone attacks. As one of my Pakistani friends said after the tragedy in Paris, terrorism is deplorable in Paris and in Peshawar, where he's experienced the terror of American drones flying overhead.
My guest is retired philosophy professor Ron Hirschbein, and his book is The United States and Terrorism, an Ironic Perspective. I mentioned that you had taught philosophy and that you also founded the university's Peace Institute. Mm-hmm. And then you also were a two-term president of Concerned Philosophers for Peace. And I understand this is the largest group of philosophers concerned with the causes of war and the prospects of peace. So how did you get involved with that?
Well, a long time ago, a friend of mine when I was living in San Diego, met him through some affiliation I had with San Diego State, asked if I had any interest in war and peace studies. This was way back during the Vietnam War. So I started thinking and writing about that, and then I learned that there was a new organization of, I was going to say like-minded, but at least of philosophers and some other academics concerned with really confronting the issues of the causes of war and prospects for peace. I hesitated to say like-minded because I'm pleased to say we had and still have a diversity of hidden. We have some people from the Naval Academy, and I think from the Air Force Academy. So it's
in this group.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very important to have a diversity of opinion. Mm-hmm. So it would just be incredibly boring to deal with everyone who thinks just like me. Rather incestuous, I would think.
Well, I would like to ask you about, you have members of your family that, for example, you have a daughter who's an insurance executive in Chicago. Mm-hmm. Your son in Sacramento is a doctor. And then your wife is an academic.
Yes.
And I'm just imagining over coffee what kind of discussions you might have. Do you bounce your ideas off your wife and say, well, dear, what do you think of this?
My wife is very straightforward and like many other people, she doesn't always agree with me.
And okay, that's what I was wondering.
Yeah, she'll always, I mean, obviously she's supportive and she's put up with me for many years, which clearly she's deserving some prize for that. But in any case, no.
What is her field, by the way?
Social science.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, she will point out some of the flaws in my thinking, and she does tend to want to keep me honest.
So when you were writing this book, did you get any pushback from people that you talked to? Or you probably, most of the people you would come in contact with would see your point, where the people that said, oh, no, no, Ron, you've got it all wrong.
Yeah. Well, the going to conferences and looking at some of the dominant literature simply focused on the terrorist, jihadist, bad guys. That was a veritable obsession. In fact, very little attention was paid to basic white Anglo-Saxon American citizens who perpetrated, according to the Department of Homeland Security and others, have perpetrated most of the, unquote, terrorist acts, such as the tragedy in Charleston, killing the churchgoers, blowing up the federal building. Most of these acts were not committed by the Islamic jihadists, which is not, of course, to condone the acts that that were committed. The other thing I noticed is that, and in some ways I would have to admit to pandering to this, terrorism has become a very hot, very sensationalized topic. So if we actually look at the threat to ordinary Americans in this country, it's...
And more likely to get struck by lightning, probably.
Or drowning in a bathtub, mm-hmm. Yeah. Or if you want to look at some of the real threats, well, of course, driving on the highway, addiction to drugs such as alcohol and nicotine, air pollution. What's the estimate from the CDC? About 30,000 Americans a year die from the flu. Funny thing, these threats are real, tragic, but don't get blown out of proportion. But the tragic events, most recently in San Bernardino, do.
And yet these terrorists that are homegrown.
Yeah.
Well, the United States, when we're studying history as school children, we come up learning about World War II, and we're always the good guys, and there's never an opposing perspective on this situation. What should we do then? Should we teach our school children? How should we teach history in our schools, of history of World War II? What would you suggest?
That is a very rough question. Some philosophers, this guy named Rorty, one I respect, comes up with this suggestion, which is plausible but troubling. K through 12, it's important to have a sense of cohesion and national unity. So we teach American mythology. College then is about demythologizing. I would think that, I'm not so sure of this. I suppose I would go against this notion that patriotism is a belief that your country is the best in the world because you happen to be born there. That's not original with me. That's George Bernard Shaw. But in any case, I would go to some lengths to talk about the shadow side of U.S. history. I wouldn't try to eclipse that, because it can become very very disillusioning later on to realize that you've been lied to time and time again. Yeah. Well, what do you think, Nancy? Let me put you on the spot, since you just put me on the spot.
Well, you know what, Ron? Unfortunately, we're out of time. Saved by the bell. It's been a pleasure talking to you about your book, Ron.
Likewise. And as I told you earlier, this is a great medium for me. My TV students used to always tell me I had a great radio face.
My guest has been retired Professor Ron Hirschbein. His book is The United States and Terrorism, An Ironic Perspective. After a short break, I'll be talking to Professor Bo Groskup about his latest book, Strategic Terror, The Politics and Ethics of Aerial Bombardment. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. After 40 years of teaching, Beau Grosskopf retired from the political science department at Chico State University, where he taught international relations, U.S. foreign policy, and the politics of terrorism. For 19 years, he co-hosted the Peace and Social Justice program on KZFR Community Radio in Chico. He has been interviewed on MSNBC, NPR, and Fox Cable TV's Bill O'Reilly. He was a member of the Chico Peace and Justice Center Board of Directors, a former president of the Chico chapter of the California Faculty Association. Beau Grosskopf has studied terrorism for many years, and his 1988 book, The Newest Explosions of Terrorism, is now in its fourth edition. His most recent book is Strategic Terror, The Politics and Ethics of Aerial Bombardment. Beau Grosskopf, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy.
I want to get right to what you tell us in this book about how we don't want to call ourselves terrorism, and we go to rather elaborate lengths to avoid that. I'm going to, this is a quote now from your chapter 9, which is called Dodging the Terrorism Label. You write, for over half century, the United States has used strategic bombing to wreak havoc on millions of civilians and on all aspects of civilian life. This rationalization scheme has been invoked to dodge any link between every aspect of the United States military action and terrorism. And then you quote from a Danish newspaper. This Danish newspaper says the English-speaking press, this is during the 1991 Gulf War now, has these different terms depending on whether they're talking about us, the good guys, self, or the other, the enemy, the bad guys. So what are some of these labels?
Well, just for example, this is called linguicide, is the term that Norman Solomon came up with to discuss this issue. But for example, the Allies, we're talking about the list here, the Allies have and the Iraqis have. So for example, the Allies have guidelines for journalists, whereas the Iraqis have censorship. We brief the press, they issue propaganda. The Allies neutralize people. The Iraqis kill. The Allies hold on, whereas the Iraqis bury themselves in a hole. We conduct precision bombing. They fire wildly at anything. The Allied missiles do extensive damage. The Iraqi missiles cause civilian casualties. George Bush is balanced. Saddam Hussein is mad, just for an example.
Well, I think one of the local Chico papers said that you were more dangerous than Saddam Hussein. Did they say that about you?
Yes, there were a group of us during the first Iraqi war who gave a panel on the war, and the conclusion was that we were more dangerous than Saddam Hussein because we had control over youth, the minds of the youth of America, being professors, and therefore we were more dangerous.
Were you kind of flattered that they said you were that powerful?
Well, flattered, but I knew it wasn't true.
My guest is retired Professor Beau Grosskopf, and he has written a book, Strategic Terror, The Politics and Ethics of Aerial Bombardment. And you, in your book, you go into this history of the U.S. military operations using aerial bombardment. And people might be surprised at how far back this history extends.
It's called strategic bombing theory, Nancy, and it came about at the end of World War I with the advent of two things. One was the discussion about how World War I, being trench warfare, was a defensive war. And that bothered any military strategist because to win a war, you want to be on the offensive. And during World War I, there wasn't any technology that came about that would allow either side to be on the offensive and it'd be a decisive weapon of war, as they called it. So that meant that they were on the defensive. And more to the point, with little gender analysis here, they talk about being on the offensive as fighting like a man, and when you're on the defensive, you're fighting like a woman, a feminized war. That also bothers military strategists. So with the advent of the airplane, the argument was that, oh, all of a sudden we have the decisive weapon to win future wars if we use it correctly or properly or effectively. And that was what's called strategic bombing. And these four, what they were called, the prophets, one being Billy Mitchell, who's the godfather of our Air Force, came up with a strategy that said the way to win wars in the future is to use the decisive weapon of the airplane and bomb civilian cities, the center, because they extended the battlefield to the cities of the enemy, bomb the cities purposely, kill a lot of civilians, wound a lot of civilians. Then you go to the next city because there'll be lots of refugees, so you bomb that city and keep doing that. And eventually, because the people you are injuring or people who are suffering from what's called terror from the sky are civilians. Now, who are civilians? Well, civilians, for the most part, are women and children. And their argument was that women and children don't have the same fortitude to withstand the terror from the sky, and that they will eventually force their government to sue for peace. And their argument was that it's going to be a very effective war because it's going to be a quick war, given the fact that women, children don't have the ability to withstand the horror from the sky. Secondly, they argued it was going to be a cheap war because you don't have to have a standing army or navy, and that means it's less expensive. And further, they argued it's a less immoral war because of, again, being short. But they also argued that the good thing was, as one of the prophets, an Italian general by the name of Duhart, said, we're going to be able to save the real people that count in society, and that's the warrior class. You're not going to kill the warrior class. And so for those reasons, and by the way, they were very clear that it was a strategy of terrorism. They were unabashed.
Because in those days, that was good.
Well, that was proper. That's true, although there were the Hague conventions that are already said, maybe there's something wrong with this. But clearly, we're not in the contemporary age where terrorism is the most dreadful deed you can do to somebody. So they were unabashed, and that is a strategy of terrorism. And it's the combination of what happened during World War II and then the advent of the airplane that brought about strategic—
You mean what happened in World War I?
World War I and brought about strategic bombing theory, as it's called.
Well, I can just imagine. I mean, I know I'm exaggerating, but they're sitting around saying, oh, look what's happening in Mexico. Here's our chance. And off they go, and say they, General Jack Pershing, with his squadron. And here's their chance to show, here's what the airplanes can do. And I was shocked, 700 sorties?
Yeah.
And yet they didn't, who they were after was Pancho Villa. And they didn't catch him, but there was their chance. And it seemed like after that, anytime there was something going on in the world, they said, okay, here's another chance to test this aerial bombardment.
Yes, and we're still testing it. That's what Shock and Awe was all about. We sort of laugh about the concept Shock and Awe, but Shock and Awe is simply a code for strategic bombing theory, the modern sort, which allegedly is different because it doesn't purposely target civilians. It does purposely target civilian infrastructure, like bridges and highways and airports and electrical grids and dams and things like that. And by the way, there's an awful lot of collateral damage as a result.
I was thinking when I was reading these different theories of during the Civil War when Sherman says, let's just skip trying to kill soldiers. Let's march through the farmlands and cut off their food supply by destroying farms and their source of supplies. And so he marches through Georgia burning and, of course, burned Atlanta. And I'm wondering if that also plays into this idea that if you torture the civilians, they're going to rise and say, stop already.
Well, historically, you know, civilians were fair target. There wasn't really any distinction. It was really in the early part of the 20th century with the Hague Conventions that they began to try to separate out the actual battlefield from the home front. But what strategic bombing theory does is recollapse those, you know, those different areas and distinctions, yeah.
Well, you refer often to for-profits and their theory. So you did mention one of them earlier because he's the one whose name is on this. But who were these for-profits that you keep referring to?
Well, just briefly, two of them were British. One, as I mentioned, was Billy Mitchell, the famous Billy Mitchell, who was the godfather of our modern Air Force. You have to remember at this time there wasn't a separate service called the Air Force anywhere.
Mm-hmm. And then in my lifetime.
No. And then the fourth one was the Italian General Duart. And you can tell they're all military men. They weren't all pilots. They were thinkers, and they were concerned with how do we get away from this defensive posture that we've talked. We don't want to fight like girls.
We did in World War I.
Yeah, we don't want to fight like girls anymore. And so they saw the advantages of the airplane and that new technology that would be the decisive weapon to win future wars.
You refer to them as the architects, this strategic bombing idea as being the most moral way to conduct warfare.
Right.
Because that's in the title of your book,
right.
The Politics and Ethics of Aerial Bombardment.
Right. Duart said, well, less immoral, actually. yeah. But it basically it was that I described because you're shortening war in terms of time and you're killing fewer people. And for both those reasons, they said it was less immoral than the other way of fighting.
My guest is retired Professor Bo Groskop, and he's made a study of terrorism, and his most recent book is Strategic Terror, The Politics and Ethics of Aerial Bombardment. And I have a friend who from time to time would mention this uncle of his that was a bomber in World War II. And he mentioned something about his bombing in Iraq. And I thought he must be confused because I didn't know that the British, our allies, were bombing Afghanistan, for example. This was 1919, and you mentioned this in your book. You said that in 1919, under the command of the future and controversial air power chief, Arthur Harris, the British bombarded Afghanistan cities of Jalalabad and Kabul. They're bombing Afghanistan in 1919.
Well, yeah, the bombing actually, the British and the Germans bombed, used the airplane in World War II, World War I, mm-hmm. I'm sorry. And after that, they began to test the theory in the colonial areas, of which Iraq was one. And
maybe people have forgotten that.
Well, the British, you know, have warned us about Iraq, you know. But and there's a reason. But no, that's when they started to say, "Oh, let's see if indeed, you know, this is true." And of course, we'll bomb the savages of the colonies. Then who cares? And indeed, they did, as did the French and as did the Italians. The first time that strategic bombing theory was used on white folk was against the Spanish during the Spanish Civil War.
Mm-hmm. Kind of a trial run for the Second
World War. It was a trial run both for the fascists, but also for the supporters of the Republic.
I might remind people that's 1936.
1936 through 39, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, going back to Sir Arthur Harris, you call him Bomber Harris. For Harris, you say what was true of Iraq was true of Germany. And there's a historian who said of Sir Arthur Harris, this is a general. He genuinely believed that the German people could be cowed from the air as he had once cowed the tribesmen of Iraq. So he had cowed the tribesmen of Iraq. So World War II comes along, and he thought, well, the same thing will work with the Germans.
Well, because of his racist view of the Germans. It was the Huns. It was depicted in cartoons mm-hmm. and in language and et cetera. But also because the technology was much different than in 1919, had been, advanced with the the Air Force had become a major part of the war capability of the European nations.
In your book, you say the air policing of Iraq provided the blueprint for future bombing.
Yeah.
And, I thought it was also interesting that when they started reporting back to England, there's reports of Iraqi women and children dying at the hands of British air crews, that Churchill, at the time he was Air and Colonial Secretary, he was so disturbed by hearing these reports, and he was an enthusiast for aerial bombing. But what did he do? What was his reactions? This is disturbing information. So what did he do?
Well, as I remember, he basically had a bit of a quandary. He had a bit of a, is this really where we want to be and this what we want to do? But in the end, he was, as you say, he was a complete enthusiast of this new technology and to be utilized to win wars.
But also you say in your book that Churchill finally asked to be spared the details of British air raids against civilians. He said, just don't tell me about it. He didn't say don't do it. He just said, just don't tell me about it. And that's kind of what we do. We don't want to be labeled terrorists.
Yeah.
Because we're the good guys.
Well, indeed, that is true of him. He wanted it to be invisible. He didn't want to know. And we've continued that tradition along with the other things that were reported in 1991 that we read in terms of, the United States has an army, Iraq has Saddam has a war machine, just as another mm-hmm. example. We continue to do this. If you go back just a few weeks ago when the U.S. bombed the Doctors Without Borders hospital, in Afghanistan, they went through a whole litany of trying to dodge the terrorism label, successfully, by the way, and it gives all of us, here
a
at home.
A clear conscience.
Well, it gives us moral comfort and psychological comfort. So first, for example, we heard that, there were terrorists there in the hospital, so it was a military target, and then they said, proved not to be the case. And then they said, the Allies did it. So let's blame the Allies. And then, that was ours. So then they jumped to the shield argument that the enemy was using civilians as a shield. And so, by the way, everybody should know that that argument falls apart because in U.S. military doctrine, if an enemy does that, then it becomes a military target. So it's sort of a falsity to say, it's an effective thing for the enemy to do. It's sort of stupid, actually, because the U.S. is determined that, military target. So it's not something that's going to hold anybody safe. And then they went to, the fog of war. The technology failed. It was in the command structure. And then finally, war is hell. And so we go through all of these machinations. By the way, very effectively, and this is exactly, if you go back and you look at the news reports and what's coming out of the Pentagon in terms of the bombing of the hospital, it's exactly the scenario that we went through. And the whole effort is to dodge the terrorism label, because the most politically incorrect thing you can do is to label the United States a terrorist state. That's politically incorrect.
My guest is Bo Groskopf. He has studied terrorism, and his most recent book is Strategic Terror, The Politics and Ethics of Aerial Bombardment. And we mentioned this air squadron leader, Arthur Harris, who was British. And unlike Churchill, who had qualms about bombing women and children in Iraq, Arthur Harris did not. And his grandnephew happens to be a friend of mine, and he said that Arthur Harris was often referred to as a butcher. In your book, you call him bomber. And we use terms. Here's another example you give that and after World War I, those 20 years after that, aerial bombing was used exclusively to civilize and liberate the imperial other. We're just civilizing and liberating them, though.
Well, that's what colonialism was about. I mean, it was about material economic benefits as well. But really, the rationale was, to civilize, as the French would call it, the civilizing mission, white man's burden. All that language is simply to mean, this is really what we're doing. This is the good thing that we're doing in terms of colonialization.
And so we're justified in when we seek revenge.
Well, absolutely. Why would you object to this? Why would you object to us trying to bring civilization to you? Culture and technology and how to feed your people better and all the things that, but we have to remember that, of course, George Washington and the boys and the girls had a little different attitude about the British and their civilization mission, as do, of course, the people in the colonial areas of Africa and Asia and Latin America.
And we tell ourselves things like, for example, after 9/11 attacks, when our military command was furious, especially that the Pentagon had been attacked, and they reassured the world, this is in your book, reassured the world that the United States would not answer terrorism with terrorism.
Yes, again, because if you're doing that, then you lose the moral high ground, of course, and U.S. foreign policy is rationalized by being on the moral high ground. We're different. It's called American exceptionalism, which we hear all the time. And, of course, they had to make that statement just, again, to reassure and make the distinction between self, us, and other. And the distinction is we are the civilized moral people and they are the other. They are the savages of the world. And so you had, that's documented in various European and U.S. Leaders talking about, this is a war between civilized people and uncivilized world, as they called it.
So these nations that do the bombing avoid labeling themselves, ourselves, avoid the label terrorism. We don't target noncombatants.
No, because again, it's the most cruel, allegedly the most cruel and dastardly deed that you can do. And if you're a moral, civilized nation and peoples, you don't use that instrument to fight and win your wars. That's what the enemy does. That's what, again, you've got to make that very important distinction between, perception of self, right, as good and moral and civilized, all that, and then the other, who are the bane of our existence. And so in doing so, you can rationalize, and particularly if you can use that, as we have effectively, to mobilize populations that would allow them to support things that they otherwise wouldn't support, like strategic bombing, like shock and awe. If people, it's still on the web. If anyone wants to see the shock and awe bombing of Baghdad, it's on YouTube, and it's there from several places like CNN and the British and then other, and it's rather dramatic.
You earlier mentioned Billy Mitchell and the mm-hmm. role that he played, and I didn't know this, that the plan for the total destruction of Japan's cities was based on Billy Mitchell's analysis of the Tokyo earthquake of 1923.
Right.
And what happened after that earthquake?
Well, fires. Because he saw that the buildings in Japan, in Tokyo, were basically made of cardboard, very flammable. And the earthquake, he stood back and he said, wow, if we ever go to war against Japan, this is the way to win the war, because we can just set fire to cities one at a time.
And poof.
And that's exactly what the United States did when they bombed conventional bombing. This is before the nuke mm-hmm. bombing. Basically, the reason they chose Hiroshima and Nagasaki was because they were the only cities that really hadn't yet been destroyed by conventional firebombing by Curtis LeMay and his folks. And so they chose these two cities, you know, to test out, you know, the ultimate weapon of strategic bombing, which, of course, is the atomic and hydrogen bombs.
You know, you mentioned Curtis LeMay, and I can't help but think of the movie that he was a character, not by name. And he just seemed like the kind of person that says, yeah, I'm military, I'm trained to go to war. That's what I want to do. Let me go to war. He right. seemed so eager whenever the situation rose. Turn me loose.
Yeah. Well, again, this is when people talk about the failure of strategic bombing theory, because it hasn't by itself. The argument was that you can just use the Air Force and strategically bomb civilian cities and win wars. That's why they said we don't really need an army and a navy, right? And, of course, it hasn't worked.
Boots on the ground.
It hasn't worked yet. And so, for example, during Vietnam, the argument was, well, Curtis LeMay said, well, it's because the politicians got in the way and they don't allow us to do what we can do. Same with Korea. They don't allow us to fully implement the strategic bombing theory.
Like Jack Kennedy, Curtis LeMay felt, gosh, here's this young kid standing in my way. I know what to do with Cuba.
Yeah. And so that's the argument of the pro-strategic bombing theorists and advocates, is that it's never fully been tested, so we don't really know whether it works or not, because the politicians always get in the way and they put limits on us. And instead of allowing us to bomb, in the case of Vietnam, back into the Stone Age.
Your book paints a picture that maybe we're not too proud of as the United States, because we've kind of not learned the lessons. For example, the Korean War, the forgotten war. What were the lessons that we might have learned, or what were the lessons from the Korean War?
Well, basically that this is, you know, this is a war in a far-off land, and we're not really sure what we're winning or losing here, other than they're being attacked by the enemy, who were the communists at the time. And this is part of the, you know, the notion of the domino theory that was very active at the time.
Well, when I was growing up, the worst thing a person or country could be was communist.
Right. If you don't stop them in Korea or in Vietnam, you know, you'll be fighting them in Gridley.
Before we conclude, I was interested in the fact that you dedicate this book to your son, Cooper.
Yeah. Well, he's my treasure.
And you want to tell us why he's so special?
Well, because I waited till I was 49 for him to come along. And he's my son. He's my heart and my treasure. So.
And he is a musician.
He is a musician, yeah. Yeah.
And is Dad a musician? Do you play the French horn still?
Well, my friends will tell you, yeah, unfortunately, at Christmas. I would like to start again. I still have my Con 8D, but yeah. And music is very much part of my life, too. But Cooper has taken it to a whole nother level. I think, I told him, we had lunch the other day, and I said, Cooper, I might be this. Cooper, you go where your heart is. And I think it's music. And he said, thanks, Dad. So.
It's been such a pleasure talking to you about your book, about your son, and about your book. Thank you for coming in, Beau Groskop.
Thank you for inviting me, Nancy.
His book is Strategic Terror, The Politics and Ethics of Aerial Bombardment. I'd also like to thank my first guest, retired philosophy professor Ron Hirschbein. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.